Welcome. We are now ready to begin. I'd like to welcome you to our featured session, Higher Education Innovation, Facilitating Global Access to the American Dream. Our talk today is by Deborah Quazzo, founder and managing partner of GSV, which is Global Silicon Valley Advisors, LLC. I would like to remind you before I do any further introductions or explanation of her company, please go to the website, the EDUCAUSE website, or the mobile device app and fill out a session evaluation at the end. We would appreciate that greatly. GSV is a strategic firm that focuses on the education sector. They provide merger, advisory, and private placement services focusing on the pioneers of technology, intellectual property, communities, and social marketplaces, innovative learning environments and institutions, influencers of academic policy, among many others. I'm going to let Deborah introduce herself and tell you more about herself and proceed into her presentation as we've had this slight delay. Thank you for attending.
Okay, that's super good. It's always a technology problem. Got it? Great. Okay, thank you. I am Deborah Quazzo, and as was said, I'm the co-founder of GSV Advisors. We're a firm that focuses on the education sector. From an industry perspective, we advise entrepreneurial companies across the K-12, higher ed, and lifelong learning spectrum around strategic activities like raising capital and merger and acquisition work. I spend about half my day doing that, and the other half of my day I spend in philanthropic and civic-oriented activities around education. I have, in my old age, become quite boring because the only thing I can talk about actually is education. So, amongst other things, I'm on the Chicago Public School Board, which has given me a relatively unique perspective into the trials and tribulations of delivering great education at scale in K-12, and I'm very involved in a number of other initiatives as well. So I start with the American Dream, which is a little bit of a promotion of an event that my partner in Silicon Valley and I sponsor in April with Arizona State University. We support an Education Innovation Summit with ASU. It will be our fifth year. And the idea of the summit is actually to support the entrepreneurial ecosystem within education, and that's for companies, for investors, for social enterprises, for social entrepreneurs, for policymakers, politicians, et cetera. We really try to draw together every constituency across the education spectrum. We think it's important. We think one of the problems in education sometimes is that people tend to operate in silos and don't think about the other constituents in the sector who are very important and have very big impacts on them. So the theme of our summit this year is the American Dream, with American in quotation marks. Because I think the idea is that the American Dream itself has become a very global phenomenon, and I think there are real questions about whether America is holding on to the American Dream. We actually went back and did a little academic research as we sort of got sort of more fascinated by the theme itself, and actually found that it was coined originally in 1931 by James Truslow Adams, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, who was actually talking about, we have a lot of talk these days about income inequality, and he was really focused, and the key place to focus is on opportunity inequality and whether students today are really being prepared for to participate in the future. And it was interesting that Adams, when he coined the term, was actually talking about education. He had a second observation where he said that education is really two educations. One is that teaches us how to make a living, and one teaches us how to live. And I think that is a very apropos of today as well. And then, of course, there's a whole lot of discussion today, including in the recent State of the Union address, around the equality of opportunity and the need to move Americans ahead together and the world ahead together. And as we sit here today, and I'll try to go quickly through the litany, obviously I think we all are aware of the litany of difficult facts as it relates to our situation, but I also think there's some sources of great optimism. But today we certainly are falling behind as a country as it relates to college completion. We're seeing widening achievement gaps between rich and poor and amongst races. And we're actually leaving large segments of the population without access to what we characterize as jobs of the future, and we have some sort of statistics around all of that. Just very quickly, and I'll actually pull up my slide and have a view, but Very quickly, what this really goes through is a couple of statistics as it relates to the gap in education at different income levels. Sorry, apologize. And what you'll see is that from in the cohort of Americans 25 to 35, we've actually fallen to the bottom of the list on the far right as it relates to adults with associate's degrees or higher. On the next slide, you'll actually see where the rate of attaining bachelor's degrees by age 24, we sort of look middle of the pack, but it's actually interesting if you look at it by income gradations. On the left-hand side is actually high-income individuals, and at the far right side is low-income individuals. So we're just seeing continuing widening of the achievement gap that I know that we've all read so much about. Obviously, we're also seeing real issues as it relates to performance differences amongst races. You can see here just these are ACT results from 2013. I'd kind of argue the fact that even at the highest point, only 43% of one cohort achieved college readiness in all four sections of the ACT is probably something we should all worry about anyway. But certainly all the columns to the left are things that are facts that we should really worry about related to other demographic groups besides the Asian demographic group. Here you'll see also that while there's certainly a positive move here from 2000 to 2010 about the enrollment of high school graduates into post-secondary experiences. That said, it's positive overall, but you still see a very large gap as it relates to race, correlated to enrollment in post-secondary, and obviously, this assumes graduation from high school. We have a very large cohort of 5 to 6 million students who drop out of high school and never make it to this this level, so that's not embedded in these numbers. Same thing on the percentage of the population with a bachelor's degree or higher at above age 25. Again, improvement between 2000 and 2010, but serious differences amongst racial groups, which is, I think, very disturbing as it relates to achievement gaps. Again, this is just one more statistic as you look at the rate of the difference in college attainment between whites and minorities. And this is a state-by-state analysis. The middle red bar is sort of the average. And you can also see kind of interestingly there's very wide variation in the gap amongst the states. And finally, as we look at two kind of quick slides, again, this is just showing between the period of children born in the 1960s, which would include me, and children born in the 1980s, we've seen an improvement in the lowest income group. They've gone from 5% completing college to 9%. I think we would all argue that's good that it's an improvement. It is the absolute number, though, however, is inadequate. And you'll see on the right-hand side, the improvement there has been even more substantial, perhaps not in percentage terms, but moving from 36 to 54. And we need to move. We need to take this gap. This gap continues to be very wide, and we need to really focus on that. And then finally, we are looking just again at the top income quartile, the number of 24-year-olds with a college degree, 80%, and on the right-hand side, lowest income quartile, 10%. Just an unsustainable position for our culture. And here, if you kind of look at, then you kind of begin to think about what are the jobs of the future? What are we really trying to do? Back to the Adams quote about if education's here to really help us make a living and how to live, I think it would be hard to argue that we are seeing real job growth, of course, in the computer and information sciences. And yet, you look at the graduation, look at the statistics here in 2011, you have 65% of graduates in those areas are white, with 11% black, 8% Hispanic and 16% other, predominantly male graduates, 82% male, 18% female. Again, we are leaving very big chunks of the population behind in these very important areas of our future economy. Just one more look at this as it relates to engineering degrees specifically. And then this is, again, quick computer science statistics. You know, only really 1 in 10 high schools teach computer science. I think that's going to change rapidly. Looking at the 2013 AP test in computer science, only 19% of people who took it were female, 8% Hispanic, 4% were black, and there were states in which there was not a single woman, not a single minority student who took the CS AP class. So, again, I think these are unsustainable, and I think, the good news is I think on the horizon there's some positive things happening. One thing that we look at our firm is a concept called return on education, and this is our attempt to actually look across organizations, whether they're for-profit, not-for-profit, social enterprises, commercial enterprises, and really look at what's important and what is important. Is whether an organization is really driving a high return on education, and if they're driving a high return on education, we believe they can begin to contribute to changing these very negative dynamics that I just went through. And we define return on education if an organization is improving learner outcomes, increasing access to education, increasing the capacity of the instructional leader, be that a teacher or a professor or actually the individual themselves in many new models, or decreasing costs, both for the learner and or the learning institution. And we think these are sort of key elements of sort of creating common measurement across enterprises and as it relates to their contribution to solving these issues. Arguably, if you really think about it, education in general, should really be a massive growth industry if we can all come at it innovatively. If you look out in 2018, based on a number of different studies, we should be about 3 million students short having college degrees in 2018 in order to meet demand in the labor market. This should signal that there is a huge opportunity for innovators to come in and address this discrepancy. So I think, you know, we think the real question is, can we go back to the future? There was a period when there have been great periods where we were incredible leaders, and that we were preparing our students for future living, future lifestyles, and future jobs. And can we go back there? The way, from my professional life, the vantage point we take is we actually look at investment dollars and investment flows into innovative companies and organizations across the education spectrum. And we've done a bunch of work we started doing with the Gates Foundation a couple of years ago, looking at capital flows into education. And what you can see here is, starting in 2010, 2011, what had been a veritable wasteland of investment from 2001 to 2008 began to really uptick. And then we saw record, and these are just higher education investments, and something we call Bridge, which means companies that are providing services between high school and college and career. And so what we saw in 2012 was actually a record, all-time record year for capital flowing into entrepreneurial education ventures, and it was about the same number in 2013. And so we've seen a massive movement by investors to try to come in and address through entrepreneurs some of the issues that we see in the higher education market. And we'd say that the entrepreneurs have responded. It's, you know, and you'll see in each of these cases, it's interesting, if you actually add K-12 in here, the number is really $1.3 billion. So one sort of fascinating thing to me is that K-12, which was typically a sector that nobody wanted to touch because of the regulatory difficulties, has actually been an extremely active investment market here for the last couple of years, which should ultimately, hopefully, benefit the higher ed market as more prepared students hopefully come into higher ed. But here you'll see, again, high level of transaction activity. I mean, one interesting thing, if you look at the math from the prior page, about the same dollars invested in 99, 2000 as they were in 2012, 2013, but twice the number of companies. It just tells you that it's become much more efficient in an internet economy, an internet world. It is much less costly to build businesses, which is a great thing. We've also seen, undoubtedly all of you all know, huge inflows of philanthropic capital into all of the education markets, as everyone from the Gates Foundation to Lumina to Kresge to others, Broad, et cetera, are looking to try to help solve some of the issues that we pointed out before. And then we've also seen an incredible response from employers. They've gotten much more interested, as they've seen big supply-demand imbalance and open positions themselves. They've gotten very involved with companies like Straighter Line or Southern New Hampshire University and their College for America, Coursera, Udacity, on and on, to try to help address their talent gaps. So I'd just like to first look at this return on education concept and the increasing access part of it. There's been a whole lot of activity over the years. It really started with the for-profit post-secondary institutions that developed and that began to create learning seats that were needed by the adult marketplace and were not being provided by traditional institutions at the time. So we've seen that be a huge growth area for increasing access. It's actually, as you all probably know, so their seat counts have actually declined here in the last 2 years, but still it did open up significant access in the market. I think the another key access, obviously, is the fact is the embrace of online education by virtually all major universities at this point. In 2002, as you said, less than 1% of higher education institutions reported that online education was critical to their long-term strategy. In 2013, that's really close to 70%, and frankly, it's hard to believe it's not close to 100%. But it has certainly become just mainline conversation and a great way to increase access. Again, this is like it reiterates the ROE. Some of the innovations that we've seen on, some of the innovations that we've seen are there's been a plethora of partnerships that have developed. Many companies and organizations have jumped in to provide partnering relationships with the traditional university marketplace. The companies on this page, and it would appear they are proliferating at this point. I think the CEO of 2U says every day he wakes up there's a 3U and a 4U and a 5U. There are hundreds of university partnerships underlying these organizations, and I think it has obviously helped accelerate the increasing access being provided by online education providers in the traditional university market. We just look at kind of one example, and we weren't able to get the breakout numbers of their online business, but ASU, obviously the largest public university, to begin with, has been able to dramatically increase access, getting tremendous leverage out of their ASU online activities, which is a really relatively new endeavor for the university. They're a partner of ours, so we're a little biased, but we do think they've been quite innovative in thinking about ways to increase access, but also address some of the fundamental issues that they saw in their institution related to other things like having to provide remedial learning courses that were causing students to be turned off and drop out of the university. They've also been very aggressive in that innovative area of adaptive learning. Their partnership with Newton is probably quite well known, and they've been, we think, very aggressive as it relates to addressing both the increasing access and the increasing student outcomes equation in the puzzle. Clearly, you know, everybody's got an opinion on MOOCs. I think that we're in the earlier innings personally. The one thing you can't doubt is this is increased access in some form. We've gone from zero to 8.5 million in less than 2 years. It is whatever you think about it, is a stunning phenomenon. It's hard to imagine that we've had that kind of scaling in the education markets in any other kind of general category in history. And we'll see. I think there are many, many things that are going to develop here related to MOOCs, whether it's certifications or whether it's the Udacity turn towards the job market, et cetera. But it has been a fascinating catalyst around innovation in the market, broadly defined. This is a Coursera map, just looking at their participation from from their perspective. You're seeing a lot of MOOC users come out of the developing countries. Which, again, arguing to broadening the access, the educational access to places that would not have traditionally gotten access to it. They did just, as I'm sure everyone has read, MIT and Harvard just came out with their first big study on the edX, the 17 MOOCs that Harvard and MIT provided through edX, in 2012-2013. Pretty fascinating results. These numbers reflected 841,000 registered students, only 5% of those registrants earned a certificate of completion, but that's actually 40,000 students that earned a certificate of completion. I've taken a couple MOOCs. I never intended to earn a certificate of completion, but I really enjoyed what I learned. And so I think it is going to be really important to parse through actually what is going on with these sort of outcome results. It is interesting though to see that once that about a third of the people registered never touched anything. So it really you immediately took that first registration down by a third. But then 54% of those students who actually explored at least half of the course went on to earn a certificate of completion, which is interesting. And then you see that 66% of all participants and 74% of those who had a certificate did have a bachelor's degree. I would look at it the opposite way. I think it's kind of fascinating that a quarter of the people who earned a certificate did not have a bachelor's degree. So I think it would be hard to argue that we're not actually, through this activity, not creating some kind of access for individuals who do not have, you know, full traditional academic credentialing. And I think it's important, and I think there are all kinds of initiatives afoot to try to improve the outcomes as it relates to this online learning delivery. Look at the Udacity is interesting. They've pivoted. You know, he actually, Sebastian Thrun, in his quote at the end of the day, the true value proposition of education is employment, actually sounds like going back to James Truslow Adams and the learning to live and learn how to make a living. But this is obvious. This has been an interesting move, and we'll see what happens there as he's kind of partnered more tightly with employers to try to deliver relevant education for employees. I think this is kind of a completely different topic. I think this is one of the more fascinating things that has happened in the last 12 months, and it actually addresses this issue of the big chunk of the population that is not having access to jobs of the future. There's an organization called Code.org, if you haven't heard of it. It is was founded by a successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur, Hadi Partovi. He partnered with Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and others and decided that they were going to provide free curriculum through K-12, really all the way up through adult. Around CS, and he's partnered with National Science Foundation, has come up with two core curricular recommendations with NSF. He developed, though, this really clever strategy in December called the Hour of Code. If you haven't seen it, it's actually still open. You can still do it. It's they basically went in through K-12, higher ed, and globally to encourage people to go online. They had a pretty simple program to spend at least 1 hour coding. And the objective was to show people it's not that scary, it's very logical, it's pretty simple. And they had a wonderful YouTube video that had NBA stars doing coding and movie stars doing coding and all that sort of thing. And the uptake was, in 5 days, they got 15 million users who did at least 1 hour of code. They ultimately touched 20 million students in the U.S., which is 1 in 4 of the entire population, and actually half of the people who went on and did the Hour of Code were women, girls and women. And I just think it was such an out-of-the-box idea. It was so successful. He's now actually onto his next leg, which is to get the adoption, to have aggressive adoption of the computer sciences curriculum at high school levels, which would then also translate up into the higher education market. I think this is, it just gives you a good example of, you know, everybody thinks, oh, you can't do anything revolutionary in education. Nothing ever happens in a year. It's just not possible. I actually think this is a pretty neat example of if you think of something clever and you get people engaged in the concept and you have a real hook to it, you can actually have great success. So I think this is, I think, very exciting kind of on many levels. Just to kind of take a look at some of the more innovative things going on related to driving down costs in our return on education piece, I think as you all undoubtedly well know, the whole move to the competency-based accredited learning is really fascinating. The DOE is obviously pouring gas on the fire here, and it really beginning to actively encourage more organizations and institutions to do it. I think it's pretty fascinating that on the page here, it's a real mix of for-profit, not-for-profit institutions that are they're diving aggressively into that. I think that is a very terrific thing as we see the whole sector going at some of these issues. But the ability to really take down the cost through competency-based learning, drive down the time involved in getting a credential, we think is really quite fascinating. Southern New Hampshire, undoubtedly, everyone knows. But when's the last time you had a university listed by a magazine like Fast Company as the 12th most innovative company in the world? It's not a company, of course, but it is pretty neat that we could begin to have the education sector recognized for its innovations, its out of the box innovations and their impact, which is terrific. Another area, and I'll kind of go through this quickly, but it is obviously there's been, I'd actually call it kind of a scrum going on, the whole issue around the cost of textbooks, and they continue to rise, and the disintermediation occurring around digital and rentals, and the move into the market by Staples and Amazon. And I think this is totally in the first inning, and I think the we're still seeing relatively slow adoption rates as you look at it of digital textbooks by college students. I own a college student, and I know he's not there yet. But we'll certainly see that migration continue to happen. And I think this is a real important innovative area. There are going to be companies that don't work. There are going to be companies that are very successful. We've already seen the absorption of No by Intel, which is a little bit of a different beast, but certainly it's in the same category. And I think more of that will clearly happen as consolidation continues here. But I think the net result of all that consolidation will be that there will be improved economic benefits to students, which is really the most important thing. This just shows some more of the statistics around rental versus used. Another thing that we think is really important, although the California Board of whatever, it's not Board of Education, it's actually something different, but is sort of taking exception with this. But is this new, what we call new technical trade school? There's obviously been a proliferation of companies like Codecademy, Pluralsight, Dev Bootcamp, that are coming right at the issue of an inadequate number of skilled workers in the computer sciences. They are providing sort of additional credentials for individuals that allow them to go into the job market. So we said the result has been a pretty good response. I mean, Codecademy has 10 million users. Those users contribute 25 million code submissions daily, and that business continues to scale. Lynda has over four. Lynda's different, but it has over 4 million paid subscribers. Pluralsight for very serious programmers, again, 400,000 subscribers, 100 countries. So we're continuing to see this. There is a regulatory move that I referred to in California. We'll see how that plays out as it relates to what kinds of accreditation need to happen for schools like this. But it is definitely an interesting phenomenon. Dev Bootcamp, if you don't know it, is a site-based model in San Francisco. And basically, if you pay to take it, it's a very short form course. I think it's like 7 weeks. They guarantee you a job when you get out. If you get the job, and the jobs are 80,000 plus starting salaries, they give you back your tuition. Because they are actually paid by the employer for ability to retain talented employees or to attract talented employees. So it's a really kind of interesting reverse recruiting model. The final sort of concept that we like to think about is what we call Kaizen EDU, which is really in the knowledge economy, that continuous learning is really becoming just sort of completely required. That we will all need to continue to take courses and learn things and improve our credential stack over time if we want to remain employed or if we want to remain engaged. And this is just, again, some of the companies that are doing that, some additional ones beyond the one we talked about before. There's a group of them we kind of call the new finishing schools. These are programs like Dev Bootcamp that I described, where they're actually taking individuals who have graduated from undergraduate degrees, but are not fully equipped for the job market in whatever way. Fulbridge really addresses leadership and financial training, Dev Bootcamp programming. Draper University actually focuses on startup. Helping students learn how to create startups effectively. And Harvard Business School will be coming out relatively in the relative near term with an HBX platform, which will also go at providing online credentialing learning for kids who have already graduated from undergrad but don't have quite the sophisticated skills that they need for the workforce. So I think a lot of interesting dynamics happening in that market. This is also kind of an interesting phenomenon that's running really across a number of these companies, which is that teachers and professors are really coming into, becoming In many models, the rock star is sitting at the center. I'm just going to talk about one of them because it fascinates me. Creative Live is a company in San Francisco. They focused on the creative skill sets. They around advertising and marketing, around photography, around professional skill sets that are creatively linked. But they have it's a live online. They're very sophisticated video content. They have sort of famous people within verticals, everything from fashion to advertising to marketing to you name it. They broadcast live, and then you can actually purchase a subscription to be able to go into the library, and if you because the live courses are packed tightly in like 3 to 4 days. But I think one of the more interesting things is that most popular classes attract 150,000 students. And they've had over 1 million students come from over 200 countries. One of the interesting things is the teachers come out live. They broadcast from the studio in San Francisco and can actually make very, I mean, substantial dollars just for 4 days of work. I've been trying to think myself of what I could teach. $100,000 or more for that, and then they basically make money on the subscription sales into perpetuity as long as their content is in the library. To me, I just think everything we can do to elevate learning leaders is a great thing, and I think there are just some really interesting things happening with that really across a lot of these businesses. Final kind of topic, you know, I just am going to raise, which we think around innovation, which we think is just fascinating, is what we call knowledge as a currency. Clearly, there is a liquefaction going on in the credential market. It used to be that you went to college and you got your credential and that was it. You could take off and, you know, maybe you got one more credential from another traditional university and you were done. We are seeing it's becoming an exchange. We're seeing people add all kinds of credentialings. I heard badges being talked about in the prior session. I don't know whether badges is the relevant issue or just people are wanting to get credit for other things they are learning beyond your traditional university degree, or maybe instead of your traditional university degree. We're seeing really interesting companies being developed around skill measurement. You can see what's your NAC. They've been widely covered. There was a great article in the Atlantic magazine that talked about NAC and its founder. Guild Smarterer. Smarterer is an interesting business. You can go on Smarterer, and it's a crowdsourced model, an algorithmic crowdsourced model. Within 60 seconds, they can tell you precisely your skill level in Word, for example, or Excel, or programming, or because of the knowledge of the crowd is so deep at this point that they can actually very accurately assess the sophistication of your credential. You can then use that credential and put it on LinkedIn or put it into your e-portfolio or whatever. So that's the group in the middle is really what I'd call credential assembly. We see companies like Parchment, which is the co-founder of Blackboard, Matt Patinsky, accredited, degreed, a number of companies out there trying to think about how they can facilitate the fact that we are moving beyond just having the traditional credential, and there needs to be a way to package that and to use it and to deploy it with employers and for it to have credibility, most importantly. And then we're seeing, a real move, we think, to skill exchanges. We think that the ultimate, play here is you have a personal, what we call personal knowledge exchange, but you've got your university piece, which is one component of it, but then you have all kinds of other inputs coming from if you took a course at Codecademy or General Assembly or others. We really think the fact that as we move forward, knowledge really does become a currency in a liquid market. And I think it's all about, obviously, the Carnegie Unit report's about to come out, and there's certainly been lots written about that. But I think whatever the report says, I think we are moving beyond just a simplistic look at how credentialing is measured in this economy. So the last thing that I pose is in all of this can. Given the expertise, the incredible entrepreneurial spirit in the U.S. economy, whether it's social entrepreneurship, commercial entrepreneurship, it just seems to me that we should be able to get back to a place where our educational capabilities become our largest export. With that, I could take any questions. I apologize, we got going so late.
Hi, you're... your slide that showed VC revenue up in 2011, 12, 13. How much of that do you think is focused on the MOOC environment, and how much is going into other parts of education?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I can give you the exact number. I don't have it off the top of my head, but certainly there was a lot. There's plenty of capital that went into MOOCs, but it's probably not dominant. I mean, if you think about it, it was really Coursera and Udacity. We don't have the philanthropic dollars that edX has raised, but those are very substantial. They'd be on a different graph. But at the same time, you've had other providers that are more partners, not MOOCs so much. Canvas is both. I mean, they're both a MOOC and a partner, a non-MOOC partner. They're a MOOC partner and a non-MOOC partner. So it's kind of interesting. I think you it's not as much as you probably think. There have been some large capital raises by Coursera and Udacity, but they probably don't dominate. It's probably 15% would be my guess. There's a lot of activity across the spectrum. I actually think that sort of 2U category probably has more capital going at it. But I could give you we have the exact numbers. Anybody else? No. You didn't have to, you can scream.
Okay. I'm from Mississippi, a small university. We're coming up for SACS, doing our quality improvement. There's so much need there, What are some ideas that you might have?
I'm not sure I totally understand your question. What you mean?
Well, for the students, we have to get them so that they graduate, retain them, to enrich them and help them get a career. There's so many different places and points we could go, but if we only had to choose one or two, what are some things you might think?
Yeah, and I certainly see that in the Chicago Public School analog. I mean, we're 85% free and reduced lunch, so I think the poorest urban district in the country. And so I understand and we have no money, so it is a very similar dilemma. I think that we've and I'm probably biased a little bit by our partnership with ASU, but I think that when they began to innovate, what they were facing was they had a new president. The dollars from the state really almost went down 100%, so they totally lost funding out of the state because it was the height of the height of the bottom. And I think some of the things they did around adaptive learning and creating one of the key things they focused on first was how do we retain the freshmen and how do we make sure that we don't have turnover rates that are, causing us to churn out half our class and then have to start all over again. I think that it's not just one solution. They did a whole host of things. They've done a whole lot around professional development and retraining the way teachers, professors have focused. But I think that was, that was to me, and their numbers have been terrific. Then it's now led them to extend the use of adaptive technologies into much broader contexts at the university. But I think that was a really important move. I do think where you can, whether it's Khan Academy or the MOOCs, it's the same thing, right? It's free content. I do think when we're seeing a lot of usage in the district. I mean, I think being able to use free resources in a constructive way with districts that are under a lot of economic pressure, because of particularly great free resources, of which there are a lot at this point. I think the integration of free and sometimes that scares institutions. Oh my God, it's free! It must be awful, right? And I see it all the time. It's just amazing. No, it's free. So you should probably. So I actually think using some of the greater free resources is another critical thing. And that would be my two first thoughts. Sorry. Yep.
Hey. I was just wondering, so much of the resources that I've seen from MOOCs or places like lynda.com, they're really focused on very employable, in-demand skills like coding. But I'm wondering if we're going to see the pendulum swing at some point where we have all these coders or very tech-savvy students who don't know how to read and write very well or lack certain essential literacies. And have you seen any examples so far of places where, philanthropic dollars are going into that, or people are starting to say, how can we get students access access to great reading and writing skills?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I think there is a, you know, because I think, yes, it is the, I think one of the reasons it's getting so much attention, one, it is their jobs, but second, it's also probably one of the easiest things to address from a technological, you know, if you're going to do web-enabled delivery of education, that's probably simplest. Actually, you know, this Creative Live example I just went through, again, it's not really, it is a little, I mean, it's writing. They actually do have writing. I mean, you should actually look at that. It is much more around artistic, literary, marketing skills stuff. And it's got a huge following. But yes, I think we're seeing, I mean, the Gates Foundation has been very active around literacy issues, and frankly, that needs to be cured at high school as opposed to higher ed. And they've just completed a big literacy challenge, national literacy challenge, and awarded, you know, 25 or 30 companies with special grants related to scaling their literacy solutions, which they found to be particularly good. Yeah, I think it certainly gets a lot of press, but I think there is equal angst around the reading and writing skills things. I mean, certainly as an employer, I mean, that's where my angst is. I mean, I can find plenty of great math guys, but it is much harder to find someone who writes well. So yes, I think there's a lot of good activity there. All right, I think we're technically over because our technical thing. Thank you very much.